Welcome to the debate. Today, we are exploring a truly fascinating perspective on international relations by examining Johann Galtung's paper, Global Projections of Deep-Rooted U.S. Pathologies.
Right. And this material offers a really unique lens, stepping away from traditional political science and, well, instead analyzing foreign policy through concepts drawn directly from psychoanalysis.
Exactly. We're focusing on a central question today. Does analyzing United States foreign policy through the framework of a collective subconscious and deep-rooted psychological pathologies accurately explain its tendency toward global violence?
Or, on the flip side, does treating a nation-state like a psychiatric patient ultimately obscure the rational, strategic, and material realities of global power?
I will be defending Galtung's psychoanalytical framework today. I believe it is absolutely essential for explaining foreign policy actions that, time and again, justify pure strategic logic.
And I will be critiquing this approach. While it is undoubtedly a provocative read, I view it as an overextended metaphor, ultimately diagnosing a massive state apparatus with clinical pathologies ignores the verifiable geopolitical and economic drivers that are the actual beating heart of statecraft.
Well, let me start by outlining why this psychoanalytical approach isn't just an interesting thought experiment, but a necessary tool to grasp the full picture of global interventions. Because traditional, strictly rational theories of decision-making are, in many ways, fundamentally naive.
Naive how?
Well, they operate on this incredibly sanitized assumption that leaders are calmly sitting at their desks, meticulously weighing capabilities and intentions in full daylight, governed purely by what Galtung calls rational reason and logic. But that model completely fails to account for the quick, consensus-driven, and often highly counterproductive violence we see throughout history.
Ah, you're referring to what the text calls burps. Right?
Exactly. Galtung refers to these sudden outbursts as burps, actions that completely bypass the rational, deliberative head brain in favor of the emotional, reactionary gut brain. To understand these burps, we have to unpack two core frameworks introduced in the text. First is the CMT complex, which stands for chosenness, myths, and traumas. And the second is the DMA syndrome, dichotomy, manichaeism, and Armageddon.
And we should probably pause to define those for a moment, because it's a lot of terminology right up front.
Fair point. In simple terms, Galtung argues that the United States possesses a shared collective subconscious. It views itself as a covenanted, chosen people, locked in a deeply Manichaean worldview. And Manichaeism essentially means seeing the universe purely as a strict binary of absolute good versus absolute evil, with no gray area at all.
Right.
When you combine that with a belief in Armageddon, the idea of a final, apocalyptic battle to vanquish that evil, it becomes the only way to genuinely explain the nation's staggering historical record. I mean, we are talking about over 200 overseas military interventions. Rational calculation alone simply cannot account for a track record that relies so heavily on unilateral violence while consistently, almost systematically, ignoring nonviolent diplomatic alternatives.
Look, you have to admit, taking the diagnostic criteria for clinical psychopathy specifically, the text cites the British Mental Health Act of 1959, and applying it to a superpower of hundreds of millions of people is an incredibly provocative, almost audacious move by Galtung.
It is, but it fits.
I understand the allure of that theory. I really do. It makes a complex world feel governed by a neat, overarching narrative. But I firmly reject the methodology. Even Galtung himself includes a crucial caveat in the text, noting that a country is not a single person with one voice. You simply cannot ignore the vast domestic diversity, the competing factions, and the institutional friction within it.
But doesn't the consistency of the foreign policy, regardless of the domestic faction in power, point exactly to a shared underlying pathology?
I come at it from a different way. When we look at foreign policy, what the text labels as subconscious pathologies or gut-brain reflexes are actually highly conscious rational calculations made by specific actors. They may be deeply cynical, and they certainly may be flawed, but they are based on concrete domestic politics, economic interests, and the pursuit of geopolitical hegemony. To use psychoanalytic diagnostic criteria on a massive superpower isn't just an overextended metaphor, it is an analytical misstep. It risks actively obscuring the very real, very conscious material power dynamics, who controls resources, who benefits from defense spending, who dictates trade that actually drive global affairs.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. By looking at a specific historical event that Galting analyzes deeply, the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. If we view this purely through the lens of rational strategic calculus, the justification falls apart. As the text explicitly points out, top military figures at the time, including General Eisenhower, Admiral Leahy, and General Arnold of the Army Air Force, actually opposed the use of the bomb.
Right, the military necessity was heavily debated.
Furthermore, Joseph Rothblatt, the prominent Nobel Prize-winning physicist, famously left the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos when it became clear the weapon would not be used defensively against Germany as originally intended.
So you're suggesting the military and scientific consensus was actually against it?
Exactly. It lacked pure military necessity. Instead, Galting argues this decision perfectly aligns with the CNT and DMA framework. It was an archetypal Armageddon response to the sacrilege of Pearl Harbor. Under what the text labels Archetype 2, the U.S. views itself as a sacred land, God's new Canaan. Therefore, a transgression against it isn't just a standard act of war, it is a profound sacrilege that demands an ultimate, divine-like punishment from the heavens. The populations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki had relatively minor military significance, but as the recipients of an ultimate, apocalyptic punishment, they were ideal targets. The decision wasn't pure strategy. It was a subconscious need for biblical retribution against a non-white nation that dared to strike sacred land.
Wait, but the text's own historical evidence completely undermines that idea. You're framing this as a blind, subconscious reflex, a burp from the gut brain. But President Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill literally sat down and mapped this out strategically months in advance. Galting himself mentions the September 1944 Hyde Park Agreement. In that historical record, they explicitly agreed that when the bomb was finally available, it might be used against the Japanese after mature consideration.
But does planning a weapon's use negate the pathological motivation behind it?
I would argue it negates the idea that it's a subconscious reflex bypassing the head brain. The motive was not to satisfy an archetype of divine punishment. It was an incredibly conscious, deliberate, and strategic choice. The goals were brutally clear: force a rapid Japanese capitulation, save American GI lives from a bloody mainland invasion, and crucially, establish post-war global hegemony. They needed to demonstrate unprecedented power to check the Soviet Union's advance in Asia and Europe. Calling this a punishment for sacrilege driven by a collective gut brain is an unnecessary psychological projection onto what was actually a grimly calculated, highly conscious military decision. The fact that the military figures you mentioned disagreed on the necessity simply proves there was a rational debate occurring in the head brain, not a blind subconscious reflex taking over the state.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. Yes, the Hyde Park Agreement shows they discussed the weapons used technically and strategically, but the speed with which the decision was ultimately embraced and the complete chilling lack of moral crisis among the political elite and the broader public regarding the sudden annihilation of two civilian cities requires a deep cultural authorization. Rational calculation might manufacture the weapon and plan the logistics, but it is the deep-rooted Manichaean worldview, the unwavering belief that the U.S. is the ultimate arbiter representing absolute good against a perfectly evil other, that allows the swift execution and public acceptance of such massive, disproportionate violence. Without what Galington calls Archetype 1, the profound belief in being a chosen people with rights and duties situated above all others, the rationalization of that violence collapses entirely.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why, as we move forward in history. If the U.S. is simply enacting a biblical script based on archetypes, then its geopolitical maneuvering would be blind to material realities. It would act purely on psychological impulse. But it absolutely does not. Look at how the text attempts to explain the transition from the end of the Cold War to the First Gulf War. It tries to paint the U.S. as a nation helplessly searching for a psychological enemy, rather than a rational state protecting its vital assets.
Well, let me lay out Galting's argument there, because the application of psychology here is remarkably precise and, frankly, fascinating. Galting applies Gestalt theory to the DMA syndrome. For the Manichaean worldview to function, for the identity of absolute good to even exist, it strictly requires a satanic other.
You can't be the savior if there's no dragon to slay. When the Soviet Union collapsed due to its own inner contradictions, there was suddenly a vacant evil slot. The gestalt, the psychological whole, was incomplete. It's like a psychological phantom limb. The entire U.S. identity was built around opposing the Soviets. When they fell, the U.S. didn't just enjoy the peace dividend. Psychologically, it felt fundamentally incomplete. There was a profound, almost desperate urge to fill that void. And Saddam Hussein, along with the Gulf War, perfectly filled it.
So you're arguing the Gulf War was essentially collective psychological therapy?
In a sense, yes. As the text notes, Hussein had impeccable credentials as an evil enemy. Once again, instead of pursuing nonviolent alternatives like intensely negotiating the border and oil disputes, which were entirely feasible diplomatic options at the time, the U.S. quickly mobilized a massive Armageddon response. The rhetoric immediately shifted to World War II comparisons. It was the collective subconscious actively searching for a new enemy to legitimize its chosenness and to finally kick the so-called Vietnam syndrome once and for all.
You're saying the U.S. subconsciously searched for an enemy to fulfill a psychological phantom limb? But again, the text's own inclusion of material facts completely undermines this framework. Iraq didn't just passively exist as an archetype waiting to be targeted. Iraq actively invaded Kuwait. And the text explicitly notes Kuwait was a major oil supplier, practically the 19th province of Iraq in terms of historical territorial claims. This invasion fundamentally threatened the entire global economic order and energy market. You do not need Gestalt theory or a vacant evil slot to explain why a global superpower goes to war to protect the world's primary energy supply. That is classic realpolitik.
But does realpolitik explain the absolute refusal to negotiate?
Realpolitik explains the protection of interests. And if you want further proof of cold, hard economic calculus driving interventions rather than a search for a satanic other, look at the Chase Bank political update memo from January 1995 regarding the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas, Mexico, which is quoted directly in the material. The memo coldly states that the Mexican government will need to eliminate the Zapatistas to demonstrate their effective control of the national territory and of security policy to the international investment community. That isn't a subconscious crusade to conquer pagans or heretics. That is an elite corporate class calculating foreign policy and advising violence based on concrete investment climates, sovereign risk, and capital control.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because you're treating the economic justification as if it is the entirety of the picture. Galting does not deny that economic interests exist. He explicitly acknowledges the Chase Bank memo, just as he acknowledges the oil in Kuwait. But what he argues is that the speed of the consensus, the utter lack of exploration of nonviolent alternatives, and the absolute moral certainty used to justify these interventions to the public require the underlying archetypes. Why did the U.S. intervene in the Gulf with a massive, unprecedented military coalition rather than intense diplomatic negotiation and sanctions? Because under the framework of Manifest Destiny Archetype 9 and the perception of the U.S. as the final global arbiter Archetype 5, compromise with evil is unacceptable.
So the economics start the engine, but the psychology steers the car.
Precisely. The economic interest provides the stimulus, but the archetypal structure provides the intensely violent, uncompromising, and disproportionate response. The gut-brain processes the stimulus, instantly matches it to the archetype of the enemy, and shouts danger, completely bypassing the head-brain's capacity for rational conflict resolution. It is the only way to explain the sheer scale and moral absolute of the response.
That's a compelling argument. But have you considered how these so-called gut-brain reflexes, these sweeping moral narratives, are actually manufactured by very specific, highly localized political pressures? Let's examine the policy toward Cuba, which the text highlights as the ultimate example of Barbara Tuchman's concept of folly and the repression projection mechanism.
Yes, the Cuba policy is perhaps the most glaring example of a nation held hostage by its own archetypal baggage. For over 40 years following Fidel Castro's 1959 revolution, the U.S. maintained a completely counterproductive policy of embargo, destabilization, and bizarre assassination attempts. Cuba did not pose an existential military threat to the United States on its own. Yet, Castro's successful revolution in America's so-called backyard deeply challenged the manifest destiny archetype. Galting argues that the U.S. could have engaged in rational, mature diplomacy. It could have apologized for past economic domination and offered assistance, which would have been the strategically sound move to prevent Cuba from turning to the Soviets in the first place.
Acknowledging fault is certainly not a hallmark of superpower diplomacy.
Exactly. And that's the pathology. Instead, the failure to comply and conform, what the text refers to as Castro's uppityness, triggered a massive repression-projection response. The U.S. repressed and denied its own history of imperialist violence in the region, projected all evil onto Cuba, and refused to explore any rational diplomatic avenue. The text highlights a brilliant hypocritical example. A 1996 op-ed excusing the U.S. shooting down of an Iranian commercial airliner, while simultaneously condemning Cuba as barbaric for defending its own airspace against unauthorized flights. That astonishing double standard is the very essence of repression projection. It is not strategy, it is sheer pathology. A rational actor does not maintain a failed, counterproductive embargo for four decades.
I will certainly concede that the decades-long policy toward Cuba has been deeply flawed, and by Tuchman's criteria, it absolutely qualifies as a folly. It is counterproductive, there were feasible diplomatic alternatives, and it was the policy of a sustained group, not just a single erratic ruler. But we can fully explain this folly through conscious political mechanisms rather than diagnosing a collective national psychosis. The text itself mentions the displaced Cubans in Florida. Domestic electoral pressures are a massive, highly conscious driver of foreign policy. You have a highly motivated, localized voting bloc in a critical swing state, Florida, that effectively dictates the political calculus of the embargo for any presidential candidate.
But does a single voting bloc explain the intensity of the Cold War paranoia surrounding Cuba?
It explains the endurance of the policy. Combine that intense domestic electoral pressure with the highly rational, if ultimately perilous, proxy dynamics of the Cold War, and the policy makes complete strategic sense for the politicians enacting it. If you are a U.S. president trying to contain Soviet influence globally, showing weakness 90 miles from Florida is a strategic liability, both internationally and at the ballot box. There is no need to invoke a Freudian repression projection complex when the basic raw mechanics of the Electoral College and superpower containment explain the behavior perfectly.
As we draw this discussion to a close, I want to summarize my position on Gellington's framework. While material and strategic factors like oil supplies, swing state voters in Florida, and geopolitical balancing are always present, they are simply insufficient to explain the absolute fervor, the unyielding moral certainty, and the repetitive, almost compulsive nature of U.S. global violence. The architecture of chosenness, Manichaeism, and Armageddon provides a crucial missing link. It explains why a nation would continually engage in bursts of violence that bypass rational diplomacy and prioritize overwhelming force. When a state genuinely views itself as a sacred land with a divine mandate, operating in a strictly dichotomous world of absolute good and absolute evil, violence becomes an inevitable, reflex-like response to challenges. Understanding this collective subconscious is absolutely essential to understanding historical patterns that traditional political science leaves entirely unexplained.
And my position remains that while the United States undeniably uses exceptionalist, highly moralistic rhetoric to justify its actions to its citizens and the world, treating these historical narratives as a genuine psychological disorder of a collective mind is analytically dangerous. It risks absolving conscious actors, politicians, military leaders, and corporate interests of their deliberate strategic choices. Economic dominance, resource control, and domestic political survival are extraordinarily powerful drivers on their own. The archetypes the text describes are indeed real, and they are potent, but they are a tool. They are a highly effective, conscious tool of imperial management used by elites to manufacture consent. They are not a subconscious pathology that leaders are helplessly, blindly acting out.
Despite our strong disagreement on the underlying mechanism, whether it's pathology or conscious strategy, I think we both find clear convergence on the text's central empirical observation. The sheer volume of U.S. interventions is staggering. The Congressional Research Service noted 168 instances of the use of armed forces abroad up to 1945 alone, and the text estimates over 200 by the mid-90s. We entirely agree that this volume cannot be ignored and that the nation relies heavily on a highly specific, almost biblical historical narrative to legitimize that power projection.
Absolutely. We certainly agree on the empirical reality of the interventions and the persistent, highly orchestrated use of that narrative to justify them. Where we continue to diverge is simply on the nature of that narrative, whether it is a symptom of a deep-rooted collective pathology that the state cannot control, or a calculated functional mechanism for maintaining global hegemony.
Indeed. I think this discussion highlights the immense value of applying interdisciplinary lenses, like taking concepts from psychoanalysis and applying them to political science. Even if you reject the clinical diagnosis, as you do, it forces us to confront the blind spots in our traditional thinking and asks us to rigorously evaluate the deep cultural codes that may or may not be driving the engines of state. There is certainly much more to explore within Galting's archetypes and his rich historical case studies. We will leave it to the listener to weigh the evidence and determine the true drivers of global policy. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.